So welcome to the final session for today, and I actually never introduced myself, so I'm Estelle Pearson, I'm the current president of the Actuaries Institute. So in this final session we're going to discuss how the traditional role of actuaries is evolving and also how non-traditional roles for actuaries are also evolving, especially within the data analytics and business strategy space. And we're having a range of speakers, four speakers, from different backgrounds who are going to share their perspectives on how actuaries can best utilise their skills in the evolving market. They're also going to share their insights about how their roles in the companies that they work in have changed over time, and also how the recruitment market for actuaries is changing. Now, as in the other sessions, each speaker will speak for about 10 minutes or so. I'll try to keep everyone to time. So we will have time at the end for comments and questions. So if we do finish early, that would mean that drinks start a bit early. So not that I'm sort of wanting to cut off the discussion at all, but do bear that in mind. So, first of all, our first speaker is going to be James Lee. James is a senior product manager at Westpac General Insurance, and he's worked in insurance for more than 10 years, working across product, distribution, strategy, business management, and actuarial. Recently, or in 2013, James was chosen for the 2013 David Williams Fellowship, which is BT Financial Group's leadership program, and was also a finalist in the 2012 Australian Institute of Management's Young Manager of the Year Award. So, James, if you come up and share your insights.
Thank you so much, and I just want to say firstly thank you. It's an absolute honour to come and share with you today, so thank you to everyone who's put the show on. Actually, given it's the afternoon session, I thought we'd get some noise in the room, so can we just give them a big thank you, everyone who's organised this day together. I think it's fantastic. The key question we're looking at today, this afternoon, is, you know, what is the changing role of actuaries in the general insurance landscape? And what I wanted to do, you know, we have a great bunch of speakers here, I've just met them, but I know they're going to do awesome. But what I wanted to do actually is almost take a step back and look at a certain lens by which we look at this question about the changing role of actuaries. In fact, my perspective or the lens I want us to look at this question is, rather than look at that role of actuaries, look at the responsibility. Because what I find is that a lot of people fixate on roles. I get a whole bunch of questions from people in the industry, people going up the ladder, people who are just entering, saying, James, what role should I take? Should I take this role? And I remember when I started out, I didn't necessarily want to be an actuary when I started. I wanted to be a physio for the Australian rugby team. And in year 11, my career advisor sat me down and crushed my dreams. She said, James, that's a one in a million job. So I then did maths and actuarial. Anyway, so I remember having my first internship at actually Trowbridge Deloitte before attending Definity. I'm in Mark Hurst's team, and shout out to Mark. But anyway, I remember asking, you know, what is my role? I've got no idea what is my role. And then after some time, you know, your leader sits you down and says, yeah, what's your development plan? So the next question is, what is my next role? I then had an opportunity with Ernst & Young. I can see Warwick here, and shout out to Warwick. The question then became, which is the better role? Which is the better role to take? Then if any of you have been through a restructure, the question is, will I have a role? And if you take Julie Batch's comments before, will I ever have a role? Right. So now what I find is that when you fixate on role, it can actually box you in. Because a whole bunch of roles, if you look at a role, it can just absolutely box you in. So I've talked to families and at weddings and whatever about I'm an actuary. And they have one of two responses. One is, what is that? So then I proceed to say, I do modelling. I don't know. I don't tell them about its Excel modelling.
To which they're like, oh my gosh, you're awesome. The other piece is they actually go, you're an actuary. So the thing about a role, unfortunately, is that it can box you in. It can box you in to a stereotype, and then it determines what you do, and you can make some bad decisions. What I find is that it boxes you in because there's a lot of baggage that comes with roles. If you were ever talking to someone about a role, that person has a perspective on that role, but they can be tainted by their experience. You know, I've moved in various roles, and I guess, you know, if you talk to someone about a product manager role, they'll say, oh, don't do that. Like, I've had a bad experience. And it can just be the lens they take through that role. And so I think we have to be careful as a profession and as individuals about just fixating on the role. And what it suggests is that instead of fixating on the role of actuary, we need to focus on the responsibility. So moving our perspective from role to responsibility. I have two kids, two young boys. One of them's 4.5, his name's Nathaniel. Other one's Caleb, he's fresh out of the oven, he's 8.5 months. But essentially, Nathaniel, he loves Fireman Sam. Absolutely loves him. And on Saturday, there was fire station open day. So all the fireys open up their places from 10 to 2 p.m. And you get to go and sit in the fire truck. You get to pull the hose, what Nathaniel did. I wanted to. I was waiting for my turn, but they never gave me the light of day. But anyway, I was speaking to the firefighter as he was in a sausage sizzle, and obviously his role is a firefighter. And I'm like, what's your responsibility? And he said, it's to save lives. It's to save lives. And I'm like, wow. And as he said that, his passion just kind of came out. Like, it was evoked in him, this passion, this ownership about what his responsibility was. Yes, his role was a firefighter, but his responsibility was much higher, was much bigger. And I think it's the perspective we take when we look at actuaries and role. We've got to look more at the responsibility that we have as a profession and as an individual. I don't know if you've heard about Apollo 11. So that was when the first man went on the moon in 1969. And they had an incident where the president was speaking to a whole bunch of people before launch. And he actually spoke to the janitor. So obviously the role's a janitor. And he said, what's your responsibility, sir? And the janitor replied, getting man on the moon. And the president's like, you clean. And he's like, to get man on the moon. And what he was saying, he began to explain that if any dirt got into the engine, it could stuff up the whole mission. So he wasn't just focused on his role, he was focused on the responsibility. And I think what happens is, I believe that more freedom comes out of responsibility. Like, I have a child now, you know, a couple of kids, and I can talk about father, being a father, and some people don't want to be fathers because of, you know, the baggage that comes with it. But when I think about my responsibility is to protect him. My responsibility is to develop his gifts and his gifts, not my gifts, or not what I want to live through him. And so when I began to focus on the responsibility of a father, I began to get excited and I began to get passionate and I began to be creative about how I would train up my son to be all that he was meant to be. So, you know, what I've shared is, if I look at my current role today or what I've done over the last 10 years, I've been in general insurance and I've moved from actuarial to, you know, consulting, done product management development. I'm now really tackling that whole, you know, problem of, for banks anyway, how do you sell or protect more customers? The 8 million in Westpac with insurance, like, that's a big question that hasn't been cracked. And through that whole space of the roles that have changed, my responsibility has still stayed the same, and that is to protect more Australians with affordable insurance. And when I've got that higher level responsibility, that has actually given me freedom to do things I wouldn't normally do or what a stereotypical actuary would do. So, for example, I took calls during the catastrophe. I don't think actuaries generally do that kind of stuff. The other thing I've done is, you know, develop and execute a customer contact strategy where we lost money. But
I did that because customers ought to know about the insurance they have. And there was a problem where no one wanted to face it. They didn't want to tell customers that they had the insurance because it was costly and it'd wake up the back book and people could leave. But because I had a high level of responsibility, I said, I'm going to make that call. I gave a business case up where we're losing money. But it was a conscionable conduct call that I made and got our business across. The other thing I've done crazily is code script and act in a video. So, as Buzz Lightyear. So, you know, we're moving into this new offering, Westpac, with Allianz come October. And, you know it was this piece on actually just spruiking to the bankers and people about the great offering we had. That's not what a stereotypical actually does, but that would help them protect more customers with insurance. So you can start to see, obviously, you guys would have different instances in your lives and your where you are now, but I just encourage you to think a lot broader, to just shift your perspective from role to responsibility. And so I guess to close out to the question, so what about actuaries in the GI landscape? I don't want to necessarily answer that right now, but if I was trawling through some websites on responsibilities of actuaries, and one website said, actuaries must ensure premium rates are set accurately and that adequate funds exist to meet claims. Man, I was excited. So I guess I want us to really, as we step into the next speakers and as we go into discussion and we look at this whole bigger, higher-level question on actuaries, I think we ought to look at the responsibility of actuaries and responsibilities that we have to our profession and the businesses that we serve and customers that we serve. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Jeff. So our next speaker is Jenny Lyon. Jenny is the director of SKL, which is a specialist actuarial recruitment firm, and she spent more than 20 years advising and recruiting actuaries in Australia, New Zealand, and Asia. She's got two non-executive director roles, and she's currently the vice president of the Actuaries Institute. So I think Jenny's going to be able to give us a quite different perspective on the role, or a very current perspective on the role of the actuary and how that is changing.
So I have an even greater vested interest in the profession so that we're still around in 2 years when I become president. But anyway, thanks for the opportunity to talk to you today. So I'm not sure it's actually going to be too different from James in some aspects. One of the things we often struggle with as a profession is how to describe what an actuary does and what differentiates us from others without having to resort to talking about insurance or financial services. But I see those as the industries where our skills have developed and not really our competencies. And these days, HR management base much more of their recruitment on an individual's competencies for a position rather than just their experience and knowledge within a particular field. And I can only see that that's going to increase as the number of roles that individuals take on and the number of roles which become available continues to change as quickly as it has been. So when we want to work in new areas, what we have to focus on is competencies rather than specific knowledge and experience. I also think that as I see further developments in understanding the brain and its ability to develop, there'll be a greater focus on recruiting people who are flexible and adaptable and who can apply themselves to thinking about things in a new way. And just kind of as an aside, if anybody's not watching Todd Sampson in Redesign My Brain, which is on Thursday nights on the ABC, I'd highly recommend it, just as providing some insight into how much more capable the brain is than we realise in terms of actually changing its perspective. Now, I should probably... I recently attended a talk which was run by the Australian Institute of Company Directors, which is called Big Data in the Boardroom. And given all the discussion we've had within the profession about actuaries and big data, I was interested to understand how boards and senior management thought about it and where the opportunities might be. The most interesting presentation I saw there was from a consulting firm, CEB, They typically consult on IT issues, and the CIO is usually their key client. And their view was that, the CIO is still often where the responsibility for big data lives. Within the room, in terms of the directors who were there, there was a view it should be held actually by the CFO or the CEO. CEB agreed, but in their experience, it was actually the CIO who could have the most influence in terms of developing people. And their message to the people in the room was that when an organisation invests in an IT project, which is typically a very large budget, something like 85% of it is spent on the infrastructure and hardware, 15% might be spent on software and development and reporting, but nothing, or at least very little, is spent on training and developing people to actually think about how the output is going to be used and in terms of upskilling them in order to be able to use that output. So they're often the actual return on investment significantly lower than have been expected, and that means that sometimes these projects get pulled, dismissed as being a poor investment before you can really see any results start to emerge. So I guess the message was, it's not big data that makes better decisions, it's how you use that data and the analytical skills involved, which is what is actually going to have the input to the decisions. So information volume apparently continues to grow by 60% a year, but 62% of workers lack analytical skills necessary to apply judgment to that information. The information management abilities, which they defined as the capacity to store, access and analyse vast amounts of data, have grown exponentially. And companies are investing huge amounts of money to derive this information, but fewer than 40% of employees have got mature big data mining processes and skills to do to actually be able to use that data. They defined Insight IQ. And it was an intersection of information attainability, information usefulness, and knowledge worker capability. And this is going somewhere in terms of batteries, just giving you a bit of background. So by recognising that most employees struggle to apply judgment to data, their objective was to encourage companies to think about the business use of the data and to encourage companies to focus more on training and development so that data insights can be used to effectively inform decisions. They then moved on to talk about three different thinking types. And their types were defined according to their reliance on intuition and analysis. So we'll all come across them in our organisations. There are those for whom data is really only used to support the decision that they want to make anyway, based on their intuition. They called these people visceral decision makers, and defined them as having the following characteristics. They don't usually trust analysis. They tend to make decisions unilaterally. They over-rely on their intuition, and this can pose risks for the organisation. They're very less able to account for complex environments and are subject to personal biases. There are those who have a lot of data and use that data, and they believe the data's right and that the numbers will never lie. And they call these people unquestioning empiricists. They trust analysis over judgment, value consensus, their decisions might hinge on incorrect assumptions or data and don't account for situational context. And between these two types is the informed skeptic, which they defined as having strong analytic skills, applying judgment to analysis, listening to others and being comfortable with dissent. I see that as being collaborative, knowing their own mind, and in fact being therefore independent. At this point in the talk, I wanted to jump up and down and shout, this is what you're talking about, is an actuary. Because I think those are the key things that we would define actuarial skills bringing. The deep mathematical and analytical skills, an ability to apply judgment, to look at complex situations, and to approach it from an independent perspective. So since then, I've thought about this definition of informed skeptic, tested it out on a few people, and this is where I see the profession being able to move into new areas, based on the data analytic area, but actually where we'll be able to cross into a wide range of different industries because we bring that judgment and independence. So how can we capitalise on what we have in fields where there's competition and no automatic understanding that you need an actuary? I think We need to do it in a few ways. The Institute can support members, increasing knowledge and skills via CPD and access to information, marketing and promoting the profession skills, helping position the profession with existing and potential employers, and ensuring the education process, which we've already talked about a bit, supports actuaries for the future demands on them. Employers and organisations contribute through training and development to their actuaries. And I'd really like to see senior actuaries within organisations help to support this process, even if it's just throwing some of their staff into a new area where they're going to have to develop those thinking skills and being able to use the training that they have to apply in new areas. But really, I think the people who can really make a difference are the members, the individuals, by taking up the challenge to go out and try some new things. It's going to take courage and an enthusiasm to learn. It might mean, I should have had a new slide here, it might mean taking a step backwards. Two things, so I've often seen people when I've been working in recruitment who are bored in their roles, they're not happy, they want to move on, they don't know how to do it, and there are two things contribute to that typically. One is fear of the unknown, and the other is an inability to take a salary cut. I've also seen people who have decided they want to make a move, and they've just accepted that a salary cut might be necessary, or that they need to step back, that they need to learn something new. In a short time, they are often well ahead of where their peers are. Now, nobody can guarantee that's going to be the case. We can all make mistakes, but I do think that we need individuals to be brave and to get out there and to actually work out what it is that they want to do. Recognise that qualifying as an actuary is not the end. It is part of the beginning of your career and that you need to continue to develop. We need to actually apply for jobs. I know in the risk management space, we talked a lot about actuaries moving into risk management, and at a number of conferences I've heard the presenter ask whether anybody in the room has applied for a job in risk management, and typically nobody has. It's only by actually applying for jobs, or at least investigating them, finding out about them, that you're actually going to learn what's required. Do I need to do some more study? Is it what I really want to do? It sounds like a fantastic area to work in. Is it what I really want to do? So I would like to encourage people to do that. I have to make a couple of comments based on things that were said at the last session before I finish. And one was about the death of the profession, and in particular that life insurance actuaries are dead. As a recruiter, I can tell you the life insurance market is hot at the moment, and we have not got enough people to fill jobs. And so it's interesting that it certainly was the perception that the need for life insurance actuaries had diminished. But it's actually very, very much in demand at the moment. And I mean, that's partly because of the number of problems they've had in the group risk area. But but there is a recognition that there is a need for some skill. I also noted the comment about somebody was head of the department not because they were an actuary, just because they were a good guy. And how often is that true of people in our profession, that people dismiss the fact that they have an actuarial qualification, but they turn out to be a pretty good person to do this job? And really, I guess I just make that point. We all have something really that we start with, which is an innate intelligence. And if we can take that intelligence and develop some of those broader skills, then we have a lot to offer in a range of different areas. Thank you.
Thank you, Jenny, for that very spirited defence of the of the profession and the life insurance actuary. So there we go. If people are bored with general insurance, you can apply for some jobs in life insurance. Now, our third speaker is Richard Brooks. Richard's an actuary working for Taylor Fry. He works in data analytics as well as insurance pricing and accident compensation. And he provides advice to a range of different clients, including Suncor, Qantas Loyalty, Telstra, and the Federal Department of Employment. So, Richard, if you could come to the microphone, and I'll find your... There we go.
Thanks, Estelle. Well, I spent some time listening to the discussion following the last session with some bemusement, in fact, and it took me a while to work out why I wasn't really keying into the discussion very well, because it seemed in contrast to what I think is the bright future I'm about to present to people or actuaries currently working in the GI sector, albeit that I don't expect them all to be working in the general insurance sector in 3 to 5 years' time. But I do think they have a bright future, and I was weighing up that opinion with the discussion that I had and that I heard. And I finally tumbled to the reason for my confusion is that I don't know that many general insurance actuaries now who are only general insurance actuaries. General insurance actuaries that I know have got a mix of data science type skills and a mix of analytics professional type skills. And so I think this division into role and skill set is becoming more and more artificial, and people have a strong overlap. And the people that I know that are both of those things and working in the analytics space would almost all say that their actuarial training and the actuarial framework of the control cycle brings something to the way that they do their job. So I'm not as down on the actuarial skill set as some of the discussion that I heard. And I think when I talk for the next 10 minutes or so, I'm talking about people who have that range of skills that steps outside the traditional actuarial set. So what do I think about the future of the GI actuarial profession? And I'm taking a 3 to 5 year view, and where do I think people will end up? Well, I think the two main themes that I see are an opportunity to move the data science actuarial combination skill set into a variety of other areas and industries, and we'll talk about what those might be in a moment. And I think there's also, I mean, even within general insurance, to move away from traditional reserving and even risk pricing disciplines into other areas of the general insurance business to try and really affect behaviour, affect the mix of the portfolio that you're working with, and something like long-tail insurance to affect how the cost is emerging and influence the cost of emerging maybe at a lower level than it has before. So those are the two areas where I see a real expansion in the general insurance actuarial skill set role. And it's worth talking about why I think that those things will emerge in the way that I do. I think the first thing is I've tried to group them into three main areas here. One is a set of enablers, and the biggest enabler, I think, is that the general insurance is a really good training ground for the skill set that you need to move out into other industries and make a difference. And why do I say that? I think because it's a really complex business. There's a lot of variation in cost between people. If you think on something like personal lines insurance, there's a massive difference between someone who's a good risk and a bad risk. There's a lot of actual and potential cross-subsidy in the pricing structure, so there's a lot that you can do to affect the makeup of your portfolio. There's also, it's a competitive industry as well, so your competitors do things. They change their prices, they change their strategies, and there's a lot of value in how you as a general insurer react to those things, and actuaries are currently working in all that space to model all those things and to shape general insurers' responses to those issues. And I think that's a fantastic training ground to pick up skills that you need to apply in other areas. So that's the set of enablers. I think the other enabler that's another two that are worth talking about, I think general insurers already have a lot of data. They've got a good longitudinal view of their customers in most circumstances. They can track them over 5 or 10 years. They know a lot about their customers anyway. Not only do they collect things as part of the rating process, but they match on external data sets. They've got a lot that they know about their interaction with the customer over years. So they know thousands of things about their customers already. And they're already in a process of using those thousands of things that they know to model things like how the customer demand will change with changing price, or how risk cost will change, or what risk cost will actually be. So big data, in a sense, has already come to general insurance, and yeah, it's got further to go, but they're used to working with big data sets with lots of variables and doing lots of stuff with it. So I think people who are working in that space already have a lead. I guess the other enabler, which is kind of a two-edged sword, but the actuarial reputation, I think, is also a positive when it comes to working in other industries. Actuaries are known as quantitative business issue solvers already. We have a reputation in that space. And notwithstanding some of the comments earlier, I think we're, We are good communicators at a certain level. We've got the executives and people in the business, and I think we're known for that. I think there are negatives to the actuarial reputation. If you look in certain areas, we can be seen as narrow. We can be seen as arrogant and trying to tell people how to run their business, and as if we know better. So I think we need to be careful about how we behave, both in general insurance and in other areas, and we need to be conscious that the actual reputation is not always good, but mostly it is, and it's an asset, and we should think of it in that way. The other set of themes, is I think there's a series of pull factors to move that into these other areas that I've spoken about. I think there's an enthusiasm about big data at the moment, both in the private and the public sector. Lots of people are talking about it, they're keen to harness it. They don't always know what it means, of course, but it's out there and they're willing to spend money on it. I think that's a good thing. It creates an environment for us to move our skill set. I think also, particularly within government, there's a real theme now emerging about quantitative evaluation, evaluation of government programs and the way they interact with social welfare beneficiaries or people in the education or justice systems. And it's not enough now to make a policy change or even make a management change without knowing what the effect of that change will be and being able to track the effect of that change over time. Ironically, they're doing that because they think that's the way the business is managed, and I don't think that quantitative evaluation piece is done enough in the private sector anyway, so I think there's scope there as well. So let's talk a bit about what some of those industries might be. And rather than talk about them individually at first, I thought I'd talk about some of the characteristics that make them a good area for actuaries or the data scientists or this amalgam of skills to move into. I think the first thing they need, obviously, is a large volume of relevant data. And I think if you went back 5 or 10 years, most companies and most government departments would not be able to put data together in a way that enabled you to do the analysis that you need to do. But I think that's changed. And if you wanted to do an analytics piece 5 years ago, you used to spend 90% of your budget getting the data right before you could do anything. And that's not the same anymore. You might spend 40% of your time getting the data right, you have 60% left for the analysis. So I think that's changed over time, but you need that in place. You need the data piece in place first before you can do much. I think it needs to be an area where subtle behaviour patterns make quite a substantial difference to the outcome of the portfolio that you're working with, but I actually think most areas fall into that. There aren't that many simple businesses out there anymore, as long as often a range of conflicting drivers or characteristics that you need to sort yourself through in order to understand how a change you might recommend to a business will play out. I think there are a lot of areas, particularly in government, that are narrative driven. So if you think about something like social welfare provision, I'm going to come back to that example several times in this talk, that historically was all about people in bad situations and meeting their needs so that they weren't in quite as desperate position as they were before the benefit receipt. And that was really much about, that was about a story, that was about needs and meeting them. And it wasn't really about a process of getting people from a bad situation to, over time, getting them to participate more and more in the workforce and then stopping them coming back into it. So it's the change to the quantification of an outcome, and actually the quantification of that outcome as a cost, suddenly enables you to bring another dimension of the cost-benefit analysis you might do. So if you know a beneficiary is going to cost you $500,000 over the next 10 or 15 years, you're suddenly willing to invest something up front to change their situation. Whereas if you've only got a 1 or 2 year view, you're not in the same position or you're not willing to provide the money to do that. So I think there's a lot of areas in government that are right for that sort of quantification and cost-benefit analysis where the actuarial data science skill set will make a difference. And lastly, I think it helps as well if there's a long-term element of projection. I've spoken about that a bit already. If you're able to, if there's a need to look at lifetime costs, whether it be customer value or customer costs in terms of some of the government programs, I think that the change of the investment situation that you bring with your assessment of lifetime cost has much bigger potential to change the way things work. So you look at these areas that are listed on the right-hand side here, and some of them look a bit esoteric or a long way off. Well, actually, they're not. The reason that these are here is that, with very few exceptions, they are areas that Total Price is currently working in. So they're here and now, and we've got to kind of foothold there, we've demonstrated expertise, and you'd think there's a lot of potential for the other people to come and do other work and really expand the foothold that's being provided already there. So there, I think that's quite a rosy picture. I think there's a set of skills that are needed to get there, but I think the people in this room and the people in the industry have got those skills and should be able to make and move into those areas with enough effort and the right attitude. Now this slide is here because I've been asked specifically to talk about it. I felt a bit uncomfortable about bringing my employer's name up in lights, but then I saw Carl's presentation and they had Quantium. Don't feel so bad about it anymore. But there is interest, and I thought I'd rather tackle that head on than answer a question indirectly or something like that. So, as most of you will know, Qantas has purchased a 51% stake in Taylor Fry. And the first question that we often get asked is, well, why did they do such a thing? And the answer to that is, or the set of answers to that is, for a start, it's not Qantas the airline primarily, it's Qantas Loyalty, which manages the frequent flyer program. And you still might ask, well, why would they be interested in an analytics actuarial consulting operation? And the answer is they've got a lot of data. They've got 10 million Qantas frequent flyer members, and their relationship with those members is a lot deeper than you might first expect. So they know where those members earn points, the financial transactions that they make to earn them, they know where they redeem them. They've already got a fairly deep relationship in terms of offering goods and services to those customers. They know what different customers like, what they accept, what they don't accept. So they're in a position now, with the depth of that relationship, to generate value both for the frequent flyers but also for commercial organisations who want to either understand how different customers behave, because they can model that, they know how that works, or they want to offer goods and services in the right way to the right customers. So there's obviously an enormous potential there for analytics to add value to that. And if you go away and Google Red Planet, you'll see that's the organisation they've set up to offer those services to corporates who are interested in purchasing them. And they need an analytics capability to make that work, and they can build it up, or they could buy it quickly and maximise their impact on the market in the shortest possible time. They also wanted protection around intellectual property and the profit stream that might generate from all that sort of business, so their strategic decision was to purchase an analytics capability rather than go out and form a consulting operation, consulting relationship with somebody. Finally, just 2 minutes on what they did. What they did was they went around 10 or so providers in the market, did a sort of interview by stealth. They pretended they were interested in forming consulting relationships, so they invited those people in to talk to them about their capabilities and what they could do. The people that they shortlisted, they then gave them some data and asked them to go away and do some analysis and come back and tell them the story. And we were one of those. And the interesting thing about that was they gave us the data, they told us roughly what analysis they wanted us to do, and like all good consulting people should do, we asked them what they were trying to achieve, what did they really want to get out of this data, and what would success look like, what would the right messages that would come back from the analysis, and they told us all that. So we took it all away and we did something completely different than what they had asked us to do in terms of method. But it was aimed at the answers that they were interested in. And it turned out that we were the only organisation to do that. We actually did something much simpler than what they suggested, but it generated exactly the insights that they were after. And that was enough to move us to the top of the list, and the rest is history. I think the other thing to say, though, is that even as part of that process, and certainly now, they themselves saw and expressed a real value in the overlap of the actuarial and the analytics skill set. Now, part of that, to be fair, is due to the experience that they will have had with Quantium. They were one of Quantium's clients, but they're convinced by that overlap of skill set, and they're prepared to invest in it, and they're prepared to support our business in purely actuarial sense as well, because they want to keep that overlap and those skills and synergies that come from it. So thank you.
Chief Data Office Advanced Analytics, where he is the Executive Manager. And in that role, he leads a team of statisticians, actuaries and data scientists that are applying predictive analytics across a wide range of business problems within Suncor. And I know just was it yesterday or last week when Suncor spoke about some of that work that I'm sure your team were involved in about trying to predict which customers within AAMI might be thinking of leaving and to sort of take, to proactively approach those customers and impact the retention rate of those particular individuals. So I'd just like you to welcome Craig by getting his slides up.
Tell me what, graveyard shift, last presentation today. Before you think it's a stitch-up, by the way, just because Estelle is leading this segment, and just because I'm going to give you another positive slant on the role of the actuaries, don't think that there's been collusion. Okay, these have been independently formed opinions. Look, maybe just a little bit of my story. I guess, you know, part of it is that I really think there's fantastic opportunity out there. I think there's a fantastic opportunity in data analytics. But let's talk about how the actuary's skill set can fit nicely into that. Many of you will remember back in 2010, you know, there's all these fantastic articles and the buzzword of big data started. And I think one of the first ones I recall seeing was, you know, The Economist and also the HBR in 2010. So big data and data is power all started to get there. And of course, you know, when HBR are starting to put this stuff out, then the C-level executives are starting to take note. No, we're going to get left behind. We better do something. So in Suncorp's case, after a couple of years of sort of internal thinking, they actually decided to go pretty much hardcore and do this sort of in a big scale. So the idea there was that there was going to be a data analytics transformation and the creation essentially of a chief data office. Interestingly, the chief data office, I guess, is a bit of a moot term because really it's a bit more like a chief analytics officer type role. Because the scope of that role, I guess, you know, spans from reporting, you know, at one end of the essentially the descriptive and diagnostic analytics, all the way through to predictive and prescriptive and tentative steps into the big data world. And interestingly, from an organisational point of view, this chief data office has actually landed in the customer space. So it's actually the chief customer officer that essentially has carriage of this organisation. So it's about 250 people that have been brought in from all areas of Suncorp. And interestingly, there'd be about 50-ish actuaries within that. So it actually is the biggest employer of actuaries within Suncorp and is bigger than the actual, you know, the chief actuary role within GI. So it's an interesting dynamic, I guess, for actuaries that more actuaries are employed within the chief data office that is led by a non-actuary. But I think that's a really good thing, and I'll tell you why. So in terms of, before we get into that, I guess another one around the great opportunity, and I love the fact that we had a conversation in the last session around the death of profession. I think that's fantastic. I didn't hear that, so I only came in late, but I think that's a great challenge. Interestingly, McKinsey's Southall Knowledge, you know, in 2011, suggested that there was going to be a shortage of people with deep analytical skills in this space. I mean, this is just the US, I think. 140,000, 190,000 by 2018. So interesting. I think the last thing around the opportunity is that, you know, there's enough of the buzzword. You've probably all seen Gartner's hype cycle and sick of the buzzwords. I think now, though, the issue is how do we actually monetize that, you know, all this good stuff. Increasingly, organizations are looking at people that are going to actually leverage that and get some tangible results, you know, not just some lovely back-end capability. Okay, look, the next one is, I'm not going to spend too much time because I suspect that the last session really has, you know, talked about technology and all the opportunities. So I won't even talk about all the good stuff coming down the pipe. We can talk about that in the examples. But what I would say is that there's a huge opportunity just in an organisation to bring together your current data. So just basically leveraging cross-domain insights is a massive opportunity before you even sort of, you know, get into the big data space. And I think, you know, that's one thing. Also, I guess I'd resonate with what Richard's been saying is that cross-domain opportunities, you know, outside of, you know, traditional places where actuaries play. So, you know, part of the work that we're doing at the moment is now looking holistically about how do you connect customer and pricing. You know, I can't believe, I guess, historically that customer and pricing analytics have been often segregated within an organisation, but even then linking up things like, you know, how we actually manage the operational claims, you know, end-to-end process using predictive analytics and potentially, you know, partnering with lean agents to re-engineer processes. I think that's great. And I guess that, you know, you really know that change is afoot where you get your HR department ringing you up saying, you know, I think we need to get some data scientists, you know, happening. So that was an interesting conversation as well. So look, there's great opportunities. There's heaps of those, you know, unstructured new sources of information. I'm not going to talk about them. You all know them. What I'd say at the same time is that where you've got this massive increase in demand, there is a changing labour force. And I think that the first thing is that you do have, you know, this magical beast called the data scientist. You've also, though, got an interesting emergence, I guess, of, you know, offshore players. There are now organisations that are actually getting quite serious because they're actually offering these type of services in India and China. They're not just BPOs that have decided they need to be smarter. They're actually startups, you know, funded by US VC arms that actually have as part of their DNA, and people that have set these up, you know, actually deep into the advanced analytics space, so they can't just be dismissed as wannabes. And I guess the third, you know, source of, you know, changing labour force is crowdsourcing. I think Les is still here, so might be able to talk about sort of how that's going, because it's an interesting watch and see, I think, in that space around how crowdsourcing sort of, you know, impacts labour. But then I guess on the other side, you know, maybe we don't need a labour force. And the three things I'd probably, you know, pull out here is that there's probably three things, you know, democratisation, automation, and artificial intelligence. Democratisation is, you know, the idea that tool sets are increasingly being designed, you know, with a kind of a human-centred interface and design, so that more and more people with a lower skill set can actually do stuff. And one of my ex-colleagues, you know, was famously quoted about saying that, you know, certain tools are dangerous. They're like giving a baby a chainsaw because of the damage you can wreak, because you can actually produce stuff, you know, very quickly and very easily, but without actually the depth of knowledge behind where those things can go wrong. So, you know, many of you will see some of these kind of startups, Automatic Statistician by Cambridge. You know, it's an audacious, you know, project. It's starting off actually very simply by just ingesting a data set and being able to give you not just, you know, kind of pretty graphs, but actually, you know, text that actually explains, you know, in a way that a human statistician would give you, you know, to explain what the key features of the data are. But we've got sort of, there's other players in this space as well, and everyone knows about Watson. But I will move on. We could talk about that for a long time. So here's I guess the idea that, you know, where do actuaries add value with all this going on? And I'll actually go to that. If what I've seen actually running a team like this and running teams, you know, over a number of years, is that you really do want three things. You know, you do want an interdisciplinary skill. And I think, you know, that when I say that actuaries really can add value in this space, I wouldn't say on their own, because I do think that there is going to be a multidisciplinary aspect, you know, to the best of these teams as they emerge. But what I would say is that there's these three things that I would look for, you know, primarily in terms of the skill set. If I start at the bottom, you know, that holistic business understanding is absolutely key. I'll go back to the point, you know, that organisations are not just looking for clever, they're looking for tangible value coming out of their analytics investment. You can't do that, in my mind, without actually understanding the business and or the system, if you're not working in the business, or organisational understanding. And in fact, a lot of the issues that we see, you know, from an advanced analytics point of view, is you get held up in deployment. You know, if you don't have the business relationships, if you don't actually line up the systems and the human processes change, your models will just line up. They'll just go backlogged, and you won't get through. You won't get the value. So business understanding, obviously the technical modelling, we don't have to talk about that. That's taken as a given. And as Richard said, a lot of GI actuaries are already coming with those skills or are upskilling. But the last one that's really interesting in that, you know, the data scientist doesn't really come naturally equipped with is the concept of risk and uncertainty. And I guess that as we go into the brave new future in a GI, there's going to be more production processes that are actually running off models. And this is where, I guess, coming from the pricing analytics space, we can see that, you know, if you have a complex set of processes running, very clever stuff, there is always risks, you know, of something going wrong in the system. And I think that risk and uncertainty, don't just think about, you know, the concept of modelling risk and uncertainty, but system risk and uncertainty is actually, you know, increasingly prevalent as we go into a world of black boxes, you know, multiple interacting, you know, models and algorithms that fundamentally affect the way the business interacts with customers. If you get that wrong, you know, you're going to get, you know, big data is not going to add to your business model. It's going to actually blow it up. So I think that those three things naturally play into the skill set, the training, and the focus of the actuary. wrapped around that, what I've seen just in the last couple of years, because I think if you asked me 2 years ago, I would have been more negative about the role of the actuary, but I'm actually seeing the more that I actually work interdisciplinary, the more I actually see and affirm the role of the actuary, because they add the extra three things, which is professional standards, which the competing labour sources don't have. That sort of guarantees a minimum quality level, which I think is really important. And increasingly, communication and problem solving. Because if I was going to hire on one single thing, it would be the ability to be able to creatively problem solve. That's the key thing. A lot of the people that are good in deep technical domains, which you absolutely need to bring in, you need to bring in new skill sets. But unless you can problem solve, which many of these people I can see do not come with that skill, you're going to fail. Look, we're out of time. So, look, this was just a few suggestions about where the actuary can also evolve, I guess, to be more effective. I don't know, many of you will know about agile or lean startup thinking, so I won't sort of bore you with this, but I do like the idea about how to build a car. And I think that if actuaries, the best actuaries have already done, they already do this naturally, by the way, but I would encourage the education process to pick up some of this thinking, in this space. And really, this graph is just saying that the traditional way of building, a model or a, some kind of actuarial insight is to specify that the customer wants a car, and then it will take, four, kind of iterations of value to get there. And of course, the customer's not happy until that last thing and you've built the full car and they can use it. The agile mindset is obviously you start off with something that's useful. And you actually try and do iterations where you're dropping out useful value, even though you don't have the full specification. As you can see, the customer starts to become happy much earlier. And there's another thing, is you can see that by the time you get to iteration 4 or 5, the customers actually change what they actually want. They never actually really wanted the full sedan, they actually want a convertible instead. And so obviously the agility allows you to pivot and change and mould with the expectations of the customer. I think the last one I'd say is that in terms of the death of the profession, or those of you that believe in the singularity coming around 2028 to you, is basically that right brain skills. If we want to think about comparative advantage, I'd suggest that actuaries absolutely have to have left brain technical skills. That is absolutely necessary, but what I'd suggest is it won't be sufficient. And the comparative advantage will be the actuary's ability to integrate. I think there's been studies that show that the labour force of the future, the ones that will actually be getting higher salaries and will be the most successful, will be the ones that can work with machines, will be the ones that can actually do the best of the human capability, leveraging the power of the machines. So what are humans good at that machines aren't good at? They are the right brain skills. And so you can see up there, if anyone's sort of familiar with Dan Pink's work, it's very interesting. I know that we talked, Richard talked about arrogance. We've got empathy. It's potentially the strange new skill for actuaries, to work out the empathy with the client and keep the arrogance down. But there's a whole heap of other things there that I think, good actuaries already do have, but I would encourage the education process to pick up and leverage as well. And finally, is there a greater role for the profession in this space? I think there is. I really liked Adam Drewsy's December 2012 article here. It was a call to arms. It's now nearly 2.5 years past that time. Look, I think every word in there is still relevant. I think he's got a lot of sound advice, and I think he's also got a positive view. Looking at the success of Quantium, and saying that in his view of the whole labour market, actuaries still have that specific combination of unique skills that provide value. So there we go. Sorry for rushing. Thank you, and it's now time for questions.
Okay, we're going to have the roving mic, and questions, please. Okay, Elaine, good. Otherwise, I'd have to ask one.
Thank you. So I've actually got two comments. My one comment is thank you for all that optimism for this last panel. I feel a lot better about being an actuary now. But I did observe in the previous session when they were talking about the death of actuaries and so on, that in every presentation almost brought up the importance of the data analytics piece, the insights and the actions. And to me, that's an actuarial control cycle. It's just different words in it. Because it's exactly what that goes back into the diary. And like, so anyway, I just thought it was very actuarial, that whole cycle. And I think those are the sorts of skills we bring, more the high-level overview, the way we analyse things. We just have to apply it in a different way. It's not just. We do have to apply it in a different way, and that's important. But I still think that high-level overview, the way we look at things, it's still going to be very useful in this new space. My second comment was actually adding something you said, Estelle, when you mentioned that part of the thing with actuaries' communication sometimes is they're hamstrung by their reports, where they have to provide all their evidence and finally come to the answer. And I just thought that was so true. And I was just trying to say, what boards of companies want is they don't want to see provide all your evidence and then the answer. They actually want your answer and the insights. They don't want to see the evidence at all. In fact, they don't want to even see the answer. They just want the insights. So I think that is something for actuaries to remember when they're presenting things at a high level, is that all the evidence is usually in the papers and it can be seen and it can be looked at later if necessary, but the insights are the key thing that the stakeholders want.
Thanks. Thanks, Elaine. I don't know whether does any of our panel want to comment on those comments?
Yes, I really just wanted to comment, not so much on what Elaine said, but except about that reporting. And thinking about it from a recruitment point of view, that if you're putting together your CV to move into a new space, you have to think very much about what the person reading it really wants to know about you, and probably they don't necessarily want to know that you're an actuary up front, even though that might support being the supporting evidence. So I just think that often people feel that they need to present themselves in a particular way, and it might be the way that they present themselves as a consultant too, that you need to actually think about the person who is going to be reading it and that they can extract the information that they need as quickly as possible and make it as relevant to them as possible.
Yeah, I think the communication bit is a massive point. And, I mean, Miles is a short talk, but I've jumped into the business, you know, from the actual space into actually leading business. So I definitely see it from another lens now, but I don't know if you've heard of like inductive or deductive reasoning. I think it's even to another level where it's not just giving me the summary page, because it's the summary page I see is sometimes so what. So you can give the summary of insight, but it's like so what. So I think what actuaries and people need to do is actually give the high level statement, right? Basically start with the context, start with what's the trigger, then what's the question that you're trying to solve, then give that high level so what. And I think you then go into either inductive or deductive reasoning. If you look at McKinsey's, basically that can give you a framework into your logic behind coming up with that. So it's almost foolproof. And I think that's what we actually need to learn. So it's not just reporting a summary page, it's actually reporting the answer to a question with sound logic.
Okay, so we've, I guess that comment and those comments and questions go to one skill that we're talking about that we've identified that actuaries need to focus on in terms of a changing role in the future. I guess it'd be interesting, you know, each of the panel members, apart from communication, could you sort of nominate what you think, what skill actuaries should sort of focus on developing in terms of their changing role?
I absolutely think it needs to be customer focused. So if you think about the whole world and where it's leading to, so it's all personalization. So it's insurance is generally this place where it's a sole product, a personal bought product. And what you have is Google and Apple just owning the customer experience space. So if you think about an Apple iPhone, they don't sell it to you. You actually just want to buy it. So I think what actually need to do and the space I need to work on is actually getting closer to the customer. And that's part of the reason I actually moved more into business, because I was kind of edging closer and closer to the business in a product space to actually get across the customer insight. And I think if you think about Google and all that, they are, customers are expecting a Google experience with a lot of insurers, but we're so slow to move. I'm in a bank, we're so slow to move. And I think at some point someone's going to come in the middle and just own that user experience space. So I think, as in my view, we need to have a greater understanding of customer, where they're moving to, and what actions you should apply to actually own that space before the disruption happens.
So I'd probably just say problem solving again, but if you want to sort of stretch, put that within a design thinking process. You know, so I think that picks up, you know, a good design thinking process will actually pick up the needs of the customer. So I think it's kind of a natural design thinking that sort of puts our technical abilities, you know, in context of what the customer is actually trying to achieve.
Yeah, I've got a few things I think are important, but more from the context of when you do move into a new area or new industry, how do you make sure that you maximise your value as soon as you can? And first thing for me is attitude. I think you've got to show humility. You've got to be humble. So whatever area you move into, there are already people there. They're already working. They're already doing a competent job, and they know an awful lot more about it than you do. So you need to ask questions and more questions, accept the answers, and you've got to mix that with sufficient confidence that when you're ready to draw a conclusion or to offer advice, you're able to deliver it with authority. But you can't get there overnight. You first need to really learn the business that you say you operate in. I think in terms of a small thing, and I see actuaries do it all the time when they move into different areas, never, ever, use an insurance analogy or reference. You're in a different industry. They don't know. That's what people do. People say, oh, that's just a... They'll use the word claims, for instance. They're not talking to a telecommunications provider. And it slips out, and it's death, right? Because you never get back to the fact that you're actually an expert in the industry that you're now working in. So I think that's important. I think it was alluded to earlier on, I think, in the last session. I do think there's a need to accept... a more bottom-up approach, starting at the bottom of the data and letting that speak to you rather than enforcing your structure and your way of thinking from the top down, because there are many situations in other industries where your top-down structure is not appropriate anymore for that particular industry. And I think that requires a detailed technical competence that some of us who have been working for a long time might not have at our fingertips anymore. So actually, you need to re-establish your ability to interact with the data and let it inform you, just in order to learn sufficient about the industry to add value. I think I wasn't going to mention this. I think the last thing, it's not quite a direct answer to the question, but it's a comment on the buzzwords of big data and the thought that you can just analyse all this big data and suddenly tell you what you want to know and you'll be able to change the business magically. And that goes to general insurance and any other area that you happen to work in. I think there's a need for data scientists to be aware of the difference between correlation and causation. I think the analysis of big data gives you correlations, and a lot of them are pretty weak correlations at that, and you build them up and you get a better and better idea of the way that people behave, but you do not get a better idea of why they behave the way they behave. And to get that, there are instances where that doesn't matter. There are instances where if you're just looking to set a price, you just want to know what someone's risk cost is. You don't care why it is. But for most circumstances, you actually want to change something about the way that somebody behaves. And to know how to do that, you have to get to causation. And you only really get to causation. I think this whole big data thing in many situations is going to go full circle and come back to relevant data. And what big data will do will give you clues and reasons to go out and get relevant data through some other means. It might be targeted survey, it might be all sorts of things, then to set up controlled experiments of what you're about to do, carry out the controlled experiments, and then use that information to change the way that an organisation interacts with their customer. It's a very long answer.
Thank you.
Denny? I think I'll probably agree with Richard in terms of questioning, but I think it's about really working with other people from different areas, asking them questions, learning from them, and listening. I know listening is really communication, but I think that it's only by working with other people and recognising that that's really important that we can all continue to develop. But I think the other thing is really just flexibility and adaptability, that if there's going to be the jobs that exist now are not going to be the same in 10 years' time, and we're going to have to continue to remake ourselves more and more quickly.
Yes, so just a comment quickly, and I think so also lightly agree with this kind of last panel, that there is a sort of reasonably good future, I think, for actuaries in analytics in Australia in particular. And I mean, the key reason for that is not that actuarial profession has really adapted spectacularly to that, or the skills are up to date, but the fact that our PhD programs and graduate programs in our universities are really extremely weak, so there's very little competition in this space, okay? In the United States, you have, maybe 50, 60 universities with, really high quality, doctoral programs in operations research statistics, even some aspects of computer science, what have you, and there are a lot of people entering the market with kind of, applicable skill sets here, whereas in Australia, it's happening at a sort of extremely low level, and the way the graduate programs are structured, you do not, you don't take any advanced coursework and so on. So there's like a big gap there. So I think it's very important. There's really, a great kind of opportunity for actuaries because, there really isn't anybody there who has any numbers to actually play in the space in Australia. Beyond that, I guess the question maybe for Richard in particular, I think Taylor Fryer, or in my view, has probably done more than sort of any other group of actuaries in Australia to actually, develop those kind of relevant skill sets for this kind of new world in internally and so on. And what do you think it was about the kind of the culture of Taylor Fryer or the way you were doing things that kind of have enabled that?
It's difficult to answer that question without seeming to be self-serving. I think it was actually mentioned at the start of the whole day. I think Greg Taylor had a lot to do with that. He was very, very strong on developing insight from first principles and from what the data was telling him without putting his judgment on it. And I think you've got me onto a hobby horse here. I do think there's an issue in the profession with the too readier application of actuarial judgment to smooth out results or to massage, that's a big word. But I don't think there's enough analysis of, in the traditional sense, for reserving for things like workers' comp and CDP, there's not enough emphasis on understanding exactly what the data is telling you, then overlaying your judgment if you want to, but evaluating that judgment over time and deciding whether actually you really are adding value. Because I suspect if you did that analysis well, you'd find a lot of cases you weren't. And it's an indirect answer to your question, but Greg brought that thinking to Taylor Fry from the very start. So.
Do you have some other questions? I shouldn't have tempted people with drinks. So I'll ask a question then. So how do we get actuaries to play better in multidisciplinary teams? if we think they don't. I guess one thing that I've taken from the previous panel and this panel as well is, and just in my own observations, more and more actuaries are working in multidisciplinary teams. And obviously, that's a great opportunity for actuaries to learn from others. But also, I guess, within those teams, and I can't remember who mentioned it, there also can be a tendency as an actuary to be pigeonholed and being, this is your role in the team, and you shouldn't have another role. So how can actuaries get, maybe I should say, not how, how should they play nicely, how can they get the most out of being in multidisciplinary teams?
Well, I don't see a major problem in actuaries. I think that if you don't have the arrogant mindset, I think everything opens up. If you go in there saying, I've got some skills to offer, but I'm going to learn some stuff off my colleagues, that's the best way of actually getting something out of it, recognising that the world is, more than a single domain, and going in there looking to learn something.
Like my view of the world is that everything is a relationship, right? So if you think about any relationship in business, it's relationship, it's people. If there's no people, no customers, there's no business, right? So if I think about teams, you've got to come back to relationship management 101, which is you can talk, but you should also listen, right? You've given one mouth and two ears, so listen twice as much as you speak. So I think in multidisciplinary teams in particular, when I've seen in business, is you need to go there with an attitude that this is a conversation and it's an evolving conversation. So you're not going to get everything you want in that one meeting. You're going to have to follow up. But as that conversation evolves, you actually get insight into what the other party is thinking, and you need to be able to be flexible with their change in thinking, because we're humans. Like you go buy an iPhone doesn't change, right? But you got an improvement, and two parties can actually change. No, I don't want the job anymore, right? So we as humans change and evolve, and I think coming back to the principles of relationship.
Yeah, I might also make a comment. I think a lot of these things, I think the culture can have been around for a long time, and I think for the actuarial profession, part of our job used to be skeptics. So underwriters would be telling us that they're doing something, and it'd be our job to resist it and comment appropriately on the prices, and managers of portfolios of claims would tell us that they were making a real difference and the cost was going down, and it was our job to be sceptical and not to believe them until we saw the data. So I think that sort of thinking has probably embedded itself both in the profession but also in the other stakeholders within an insurance firm, and so they expect us to be like that, and even if we're not, they'll look for evidence that we are. And I think those things will change, but we have an honest to actually make a real effort to change it.
I think I would encourage some self-awareness, really, in terms of recognising how things work for you as an individual. So often I observe that people who have an actuarial background may take a little bit longer to process information in terms of actually being prepared to comment on something. So we like to be right. We like to be comfortable with what we're saying. And so, for example, I don't like posting on Facebook because it really puts me out there, and I have to be really sure that I want to put that picture out there or whatever it is. And therefore, in a meeting, I think we can tend to hold back. But if you recognise that that's the way that you behave, then you need to find another way of influencing. So maybe you need to talk to some people about it beforehand, understand what their issues are. Or you need to actually just be prepared to say, I'm going to speak up, and if I happen to be only 90% right today, then that's okay.
I
think understanding yourself.
Hi. I just have a question for the panel. At Migration Institute, one of our strategies is to extend the reach of actuaries in the data analytics area. And we've spoken earlier about setting up a data analytics working group to try and do that. One of the things I guess I'd like to ask the panel is, what are the short-term things that you think the institute and profession can do to, I guess, empower our members to move in that path? There's obviously some long-term things with the education, but what are the short-term things that you think would make a difference to either people in your team or people who may be in your team in a year or so time?
I'd probably encourage people in our teams not to wait for the institute to do it for you. I think sometimes if we talk about attributes of actuaries, sometimes actuaries do wait for things to come to them, and that's because they are on this kind of qualifying treadmill, and so if they just keep going on that, there's going to be a certain amount of success anyway. I think we do need a little bit more of the doggedness to actually make it happen for yourself. There are huge numbers of courses out there that are free and that are taught by the best in the world around machine learning and big data and analytics space. Just get onto Coursera or Udacity or whatever, get into it, encourage your team members to get in there. It's free, you can just kind of muck around and find a course that suits you.
Yeah, I'd probably say you just want exposure, like, immediately, right? So if you're in an institution and, like, whatever organisation, I'm sure there is a team that is starting to look at that space. So even if you were to set up half an hour coffee, at least with the leader, that's one practical step that you can take. I think the other, my take on big data is, rather than just wait for big data, I think it's how do you apply small data that's in front of you already. So I think having that ability to apply and action what's in front of you. So I encourage anyone to either look at a business problem, whether it's a customer problem. So I've done stuff with retention where you already have some sample of data. How do you already take that and apply that? And I've just used Excel in that space, but you don't need a big machine, you don't need a big SaaS, etc. But it's what can you do with small data to solve a business problem? So you start to get that kind of thinking, that application already, and don't wait, like Craig said, for the institution to start to tell you what to do.
Yeah, I think Yeah, and just another couple of remarks. I echo what Craig said. I think that there are, it's actually not as hard as you would think to pick up some of the skills you need, that you need. There are some really good courses out there. There's one of the very senior actors in the Taylor Fire Office who has worked completely in the classical arena until now, who have just taken a year to put him through one of the online courses offered by Tushrani and Hasty, and it's a fantastic course, and he's he will become very skilled as a result of kickstarting himself with that course. I guess the other thing I'd say is be brave. I think the longer you're in the profession, the harder you find it to get out of your comfort zone, and I think if you got outside, it wouldn't be as hard as you thought. So be brave, do it.
Okay. Well, look, if there aren't any more, if there are no more questions, I might end this session. Certainly, I'd like to thank the panel for being very optimistic about the future of the profession, and also for and some things I took out of it was the need to change my brain, either through Daniel Pincor or through Jenny's program that's on TV. That I need to be an informed skeptic. I probably need to take a free online course, and I need to focus on responsibilities, not role, to be careful that I don't box myself in. So thank you to all the panelists, and I will ask you to pass and get the bottle of wine. I do just have to close the conference, so if that's okay. So just before we do leave, I'd just like to thank everybody for coming along today. I'd like to thank again our sponsors, Taylor Fry Infinity. Please don't forget to provide feedback through the link that's going to be emailed to you later today. It's only by your feedback that we can understand whether you enjoy these conferences, what we could do differently, how we could improve things. I'd encourage you all to look out for future Institute events that you might find interesting. 8th to the 10th of November this year is the Injury Seminar Scheme being held in Adelaide. I'd like to, once all before you go, just give a special thanks to all of the speakers and all the chairs who've contributed their time. Finally, I'd like to thank all of the organising committee and the events team who organised today. That is David Gifford, Rashid Bansal, Rebecca Hayden, Jonathan Cohen, Aaron Cutter, Nancy Lee, Abhijit Agarwal, Les Coleman, Elaine Grace, Lisa Pronesti and Liz Gemmell. Thank you very much. The bar's open.